Good evening, everyone. And it was nice to come and sit here with you all. I'm a little bit unsure of myself as I sit up here, because I could just venture forth and talk about the topic I thought of addressing today, which is fear. I think I talked about fear earlier this summer, but it's still around, so... or we can just do questions. So you want me to hear my words?
Fear.
I was afraid of that. So, did I talk about it a few weeks ago? Early in the summer, or here on Thursday? So, what could I say that's different? Fear is very interesting, of course. It's something that is very pervasive in our culture and among many of us here in this room. It's said that in our society, something like a quarter to half of the population have serious difficulty with fear or worry or anxiety. And as we know, there's many people who get medicated because of their anxiety level, and either medically medicated or alcoholically. There are all kinds of ways in which people try to reduce their anxiety and their fear, apprehension. It's interesting that the Buddhist psychology, what's called Buddhist psychology, is an ancient system of the mind, study of the mind and different aspects of the mind. And they divide up the mental activity of your mind into a certain number of mental factors that can operate at different times. In one system, there's 52 mental factors that can operate. And they operate in different combinations, and some are always there, some are there some of the time. And there's such things as like the ability to pay attention, to concentrate, to have intention, to will something, to have wish. It can include things like to be angry, to be desirous, to be generous, to be compassionate, to be loving. There's a wide range, to be peaceful, to be agitated. There's a wide range of these 52 factors. And it's supposed to be kind of definitive. It's supposed to be include all possible states of mind. And fear is not one of them. That's interesting. And the other thing that's interesting is that when the Buddha defined the three roots, sometimes he called them the three root poisons, the three root causes for why people suffer, what poisons us in our suffering, he defined them as greed, hate, and delusion. Again, he left out fear. Now, maybe the Buddha wasn't a fear type, and he didn't think about it much. But for the first thing about why these 52 factors of mind exclude fear, it's usually said it's because fear is a subset of aversion, of pushing things away, or hostility. Hostility and aversion are one of these mental factors. And to have fear is to want something, to either push it away or retreat from something. You don't want it. There's kind of some kind of aversion to it, whether it's advancing aversion or retreating aversion, some kind of aversion. So it's usually considered a subset of aversion. And it's helped sometimes to see it that way, because then sometimes it loses a little bit of its kind of seductive power if you just see it, it's a form of aversion. Why it's not one of the root causes of our suffering, why greed, hate, and delusion is the bottom line and not fear, I don't know why the Buddha did that actually. It could be that he was wrong. fear is pretty fundamental. It's pretty, sometimes it seems like, it's the absolute kind of root of, for some people's, core existential concerns, their anxiety. I don't know who's right. I don't know how we actually decide on that. But we certainly can recognize fear as being, in all its manifestations, apprehension, anxiety, worry, trepidation, as being... at the root of many of the ways in which we behave in our lives, And for some people, it lays at the root of almost every behavior and even the thought, every thought that they have. It's maybe not obvious in people's daily life how pervasive their fear is, but some people will go on retreats. And the advantage of being on silent retreats, meditating all day, is you really get to see what goes on in your mind. You're not distracted from it. And so you don't turn on the television, you don't go call up a friend and talk, you don't do errands, or you don't... You know, there's all these ways in which we kind of distract ourselves. We're not really in touch with each other moment by moment over a course of 24 hours or 7 days or however long it is. But if you really try to do that, the underlying patterns, the prevailing attitudes of the mind that are operating sometimes show themselves with great clarity. And some people will come sometimes during interviews on retreats and report how surprised they are to discover how absolutely pervasive fear is in their life. They had no idea that it influenced seemingly every thought they have and every behavior, When I was an early meditation student, I was quite surprised by this. And the fear and guilt were kind of very, very strong operating factors in my behavior and my mind. And I would be afraid of such simple things, seemingly ridiculous things, as if other people were around, for example, how I opened a door. You know, I figured there was a right way of opening a door and a wrong way, and I didn't want to blow it. Or how I'd walk through across a meditation hall floor if other people were meditating in the hall. It wasn't simply I was being cautious not to disturb them. I was afraid that I was going to be caught walking the wrong way. It was really a surprise to see, you know, how... And then I felt guilty because I'm sure that I had done it the wrong way. And I was really surprised how pervasive fear was. And one of the biggest kind of wake-up calls about the power of fear in my life was when I was in college. I think I was probably a freshman in college. And I had this English composition class, which we were all required to take. And so I had to compose, which was more or less okay to do, write these little essays. But once in the quarter, every student in the class had to go and visit the professor in his office. And this was terrifying for me. I actually kind of had to be sitting in front of the professor and say something and report or something. And so I went in and I was pretty scared. But I don't know exactly the technical word or what happened, but it was something like disassociation. I remember sitting there in his office, and he was looking at me, and I thought it was very bizarre, because I was kind of, I guess, I don't know if I was calm, I just wasn't there. And and I thought it was very bizarre that he was looking in my direction, because all there was the wall. I just didn't think, I felt like I just wasn't there, I was disappeared. And that was, you know, and suddenly I found myself out in the hallway walking away. I was so afraid that I disassociated, I was just kind of disconnected, I had no idea how the conversation went. And if I held up my own end of the conversation, I just knew at some point I was walking down the hall. I passed the class, but, so maybe I didn't do that bad, but the conversation. Or maybe he understood how terrified I was. But that was a real surprise to see that fear could have such a hold over me. And in visiting someone like an authority figure, like a professor, for me at age 18. So fear is quite pervasive, and it seemingly is a root of some people's lives. There are many kinds of fear. And in the Buddhist tradition, they have two very general divisions for fear. There is the fear which is healthy and the fear which is unhealthy. Which I guess we can make that easily enough ourselves. But what's a little bit different than in the Buddhist analysis, among the healthy kind of fears, is a certain fear for harming oneself in context of doing unwholesome actions. So it's still a fear of harm, fear of being hurt. Like if you're standing on the edge of a 900-foot cliff, and you're looking straight down with your toes, balls of your feet over the edge, you know, you better be concerned. I think it's normal to have a little bit apprehension, a little bit, you know, wondering, is this a smart thing to do? And so your fear of hurting yourself, of falling. The fear of harming oneself through one's unethical activity, being unethical, is considered a very healthy fear in Buddhism. It is a sign of self-respect and healthy self-regard. To be have enough respect for yourself that you feel like you're damaging yourself if you actively lie or steal or harm anybody else is considered a very healthy kind of fear. I was very surprised by this when I first was practicing in Thailand. My first meditation teacher, I had been meditating with him for a few months. And then he took me for a trip into the countryside one day. And I was driving with him, and suddenly we were in a situation that was a little more social than it had been during the silent retreat. So I asked him a little bit about himself, and I asked him, I knew that he had become a monk, or not necessarily a novice monk, when he was a young teenager. He'd been a monk all his life. And I asked him what had motivated him to become a monk. And he said, it came through the translator into English, because he didn't speak English. And the translator used these archaic Victorian translations of two Buddhist words. He said, the translator said, and I forget exactly how it said, but the moral dread and what's the word for shame? It's an adjective for the shame that we use for the hiriyanotapa. You must know, don't you? Some kind of shame. moral dread and some kind of shame. And I was so surprised that a famous, wonderful, enlightened Buddhist teacher would be motivated by moral dread and shame to enter into his meditation practice. It turns out that the English was a little bit off. What it was referring to was that he was very concerned about causing this kind of self-harm. He had enough self-respect for himself that he really wanted to be careful with his activities and his mind, that he didn't transgress and harm himself through a whole bunch of unethical kinds of activities. One way you harm yourself is by harming other people. If you actively, intentionally harm others, it's also a way of harming oneself. So I don't know if it was just himself he didn't want to harm, but he didn't want to harm. He didn't want to be involved in that kind of activity. And that in Buddhism is understood as being a kind of a fear, a healthy form of fear, the fear of wrongdoing. There's also this unhealthy kind of fear, and this is what most people are most familiar with. Worry, for example, is usually considered unhealthy. Worry usually has nothing to do with any imminent danger. It usually has to do with some thought preoccupation. Worry is usually something intellectual, some thought, some idea. What's going to happen? What's going to happen in the future? You don't know what's going to happen in the future. So the future is only an imagination. And so the imagination is fueling the worry. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? We are seldom worried about what's happening in the present moment. If it's happening, it's maybe you're afraid then more dramatically, but you're not worried that it's going to happen. We have many people who are chronic worriers. It starts sometimes very early in life. And it has a big toll because worry, any kind of fear chronically or on a regular basis, is tiring for the system. The muscles are held a little bit tense and tight. The mind is exhausted. And as we know, a mind which is exhausted and has that kind of stress of constant worrying is then more susceptible to further worry, further fear, further stress. And it becomes a self-fulfilling, kind of self-cycling process where some people will spiral downwards to utter exhaustion by the end of the day or by the end of their life or whatever. And if it builds up enough and becomes chronic in the muscles and in the kind of psyche, some people don't have to have anything to worry about to worry. It's somehow a feeling in their body that something is off and something is wrong. And they'll look for something then to fill in the blank. What is it I can worry about? But it's really just kind of sometimes just a habit formation that we've gotten so accustomed to that the body somehow feels off and gives us those signals. And then if it gets quite pervasive and builds up, then it can become a panic attack, which just kind of spirals and becomes worse and worse. For people who learn to watch their panic attacks, which is a classic, it's very wonderful that some of the classic antidotes for panic attacks is sounds very much like meditation instruction. It's watch it. Watch it and maybe breathe a little bit more deeply or exhale more fully. But stop. Stop whatever you're doing. Stop worrying about it. Stop reacting to it. Stop being afraid of it. And just watch it, which is basically the instructions for meditation. But anything that goes on, just kind of in a sense stop and just watch what's happening. Be there within that kind of in the kind of observer mode, which is a very powerful thing to do. In that worry is sometimes intellectual, or it uses the imagination or thoughts or ideas. One of the ways to use mindfulness practice is to start learning to pay attention to some of the patterns in our thinking that relates to our worrying. Is there common themes to what you worry about or how you worry, what triggers it? And if you don't see the common patterns, then each time it arises, a particular instant of a pattern might be just as strong as any other time. But if you see it as a regular pattern, then sometimes it loses its power over you. You say, oh, there it is again, my old friend, my own, you know. And it's kind of, it's a little bit more difficult for a worry or fear to be convincing. If you've recognized this, now happened 499 times today. You know, but if you don't know, if you're not tracking it that way, I know that Jack Kornfield sometimes instructs his students to count how many times in the course of a day they have a judgmental thought or a worrying thought. And part of the reason he does it is so that when they get to 499, finally they kind of like relax or smile or giggle or give up or or hopefully don't despair. But part of the value of mindfulness is to look, and then if you can see what the patterns and themes are of what it is you're thinking about, then to ask the question, is it true? Is it really true, the supposition, what you're supposing, what the basis is of the fear? To what degree is it just your imagination? You're guessing at what might happen in the future. One of the small ways I started to overcome some of my worries and fear was through a lot of experience, painful experience, recognizing how many times my worry about what was going to happen, my fear about how terrible it was going to be or whatever, how many times what I imagined the future was going to be like was far removed from my imagination. Simply, I would spend days worrying about a meeting that was canceled. You know, 2 days of worrying about a meeting, then it's canceled. Like, that was a waste of good worrying. Why bother with that? And if you hear this, this idea one time, it seems kind of silly to talk this way. But I saw it over and over and over again, over and over and over again. How many times I was worrying about something that didn't turn out to be the case. And through this kind of hard learned lesson, I started to relax the grip of these worries. And I started to, I don't really know what's going to happen. It could well be that it doesn't work out, that doesn't end up that way tomorrow, and to next day or whenever. So who knows? Whatever. So I'll just take my, I'll just show up and see what happens. Or I'll prepare and do what I need to do, but it's just a guess what's going to happen. And since so often it's turned out different than what I expected, I will just go along. Also, I learned how many times what did happen I couldn't have planned for. That happened a lot too. So I still plan from time to time, and I still, concerned about the future, but I'm much less inclined to worry now about it because I've learned this through this bitter, long experience. So one of the sad, bad news about wisdom is that a certain level of wisdom, which many people want, arises only through experience. And that means that it only comes from making a lot of mistakes. You do the same thing over and over again. You finally kind of something sometimes penetrates the skull of ours and we learn. I call this the wisdom of familiarity. Some wisdom only comes from familiarity. And you have to become really familiar with something to be free of it. So some people will do this intentionally with fear. They'll put themselves in a situation where they're going to be fearful. And in traditionally, monastics in Buddhism in Southeast Asia and India would seek out places that were fearful. They'd seek out jungles with tigers and snakes and elephants and whatever. And often they'd seek out cemeteries. And they would sit in the cemetery and try to deal with that. Maybe I mentioned this a few weeks ago, but I heard recently someone had asked a Buddhist teacher about whether Americans should do this. Seek out, should they go to the inner city, someplace, you know, where the crime rate is really high, where you're guaranteed to be mugged if you walk around at midnight, and, you know, and go there and meditate there in the street corner. You know, really, since we don't have tigers around so much anymore, so we have to find some substitute to that. And the teacher said, no, Americans don't need to do that. They're already anxious. They just have to sit down where they are, and they'll confront fear. They don't have to go out of their way to find it, because it's so pervasive in our culture. But still, it can be useful for some people to go seek out things they're afraid of and experiment, kind of go up against the edge. If you're afraid of encountering strangers, for example, certain kind of conversations with other people, go and find someone far away from where you live. go to a shopping trip. Go to Safeway over in Fremont, and try to have a conversation with someone else in the checkout line or the cashier, someone you'll never see again. And experiment with what it's like to kind of push the edge of your fear around conversation and dealing with other people, if it's that kind of fear is really dramatic. Sometimes it's very healthy to kind of begin pushing the envelope, pushing the limits of where we're just, doesn't mean dramatically, just find little places and begin exploring that and seeing how we can come to terms with it. So occasionally it's helpful to really face a really big fear and go right up into the middle of it if it's deemed relatively safe. I remember there was one woman on a retreat. I'm going on a retreat tomorrow at Vajrapani. It's a retreat center deep in the mountains of Boulder Creek. And some years ago, a woman came there, and a lot of people on that retreat stay in tents, and they tent out in the woods. And she decided to go on her own, to go far away from everybody else, far kind of over the ridge and down out of the way and someplace really isolated, and tent there by herself. And she didn't tell me she was doing this. She just started coming to interviews and talking about how terrified she was at night and how she stayed up all night and every leaf, you know, was kind of crunching outside, and it's probably a deer or a little mouse or a butterfly. Who knows what it was? But, it would get amplified for her, and she was petrified. And every day she came into interviews and she was more tired. And I'd ask her, you know, why don't you just... you know, move from there and come closer, you feel safer. And she said, oh, no, then I wouldn't be facing my fear of the dark. And I thought it was really great that she took that opportunity to do that. It was a safe place to do it. And later she reported that she was really grateful, made a big difference for her. So that's an example of someone who kind of pushes, you know, quite far into intentionally going to where the fear is. But I think it's very serious that we don't have to go looking for it. We don't have to create the conditions for it. The conditions appear all the time anyway. One of the simple things to do around fear, if you can, is to sit down and meditate when you have it. Or if you meditate and you have fear already, just sit and sit with the fear. And one of the things to do with fear, with meditation, is not to confront it directly, but to try to make yourself calm in the midst of it. And one of the classic ways is to breathe. To breathe mindfully, consciously, is very helpful. The more fully your mind can be engaged with the breath, the less of the mind is available to engage with the fear. There's a wonderful article in the Chronicle this week. Did some of you read it about doing two things at once? It said that if you do two things at once, it isn't that you have twice as much capacity to deal with it. You have X amount of capacity, and that X amount of capacity of the mind is divided then between the two tasks. So you're less efficient with each one. And so if the mind is more fully engaged with the breath, less of the mind is available for the fear, and the fear sometimes loses some of its power. But also just being with the fear and letting go of the exhalation is very soothing, very calming, and can often kind of calm us out of the fear. In Southeast Asia, some of these monastics who go out into sit in the cemeteries or sit with the tigers, that's often what they do. They commit themselves to developing that very strong concentration and calm on their breath or on a mantra sometimes they use when they're confronted with what they're most afraid of. And the ones who report about it afterwards have great success. The ones who are eaten by the tigers don't come back to tell us. However, there is no reports of any monk or nun in Thailand ever eaten by a tiger. A lot of them confront tigers, but there's never any stories of them. No bones found. So calming oneself is very helpful. It's possible to be a calm addict, to think that the only purpose of meditation is to become calm, to somehow override our difficulties, override our anxiety and fear, and just get calm. And every time some anxiety comes up, we rush to the calm. Ultimately, it's not a very helpful strategy, because it doesn't help us understand well the anxiety and fear and how it works within us. So it's necessary sometimes it's helpful to get a little bit calm. Calm enough so you don't feel like you're in the grip of the fear. But you don't have to get rid of the fear. At some point, you want to turn the attention around and look directly at the fear itself. And one of the things you can do in doing that is by looking at it, kind of look at it in the face, see it for what it is. And in doing that, not be fooled by the fear, not be fooled by the thoughts or the anxiety or the body sensations that might be there. It's kind of by being the clear observer of the fear, you step outside of the domain of the fear. Some therapists talk a lot about the great importance of disidentifying with your fear. It doesn't mean disowning it, like it saying it belongs to someone else. It means you no longer use the fear as a way of defining who you are, as a definition of this is really mine, or claiming it, this is mine, as a way of taking responsibility for it, in the sense of, you know, this defines who I am. I don't know if that was said clearly or not, but hopefully it was. And no longer identifying with the fear, no longer seeing it as my fear, but just the fear. That's very helpful, because then we're not so enmeshed with it, and it's easier to be the observer who is kind of unmoved or unentangled or unafraid or unjudgmental or unworried about the fear that might be there. So to turn around and look at the fear and really understand what it is. One of the ways to do that is to feel the fear in the body. And it's great to be breathing, to feel the fear in your body and continue the breathing. You might feel, for example, in your body, the fear is perhaps maybe a kind of butterflies in your stomach or tightening in your stomach or clenching in your stomach or worse. Or someplace else in your body that you might be tight or colding or something. Or you might feel a kind of very tenuous vulnerability, a painful vulnerability someplace in your body. And then to feel that place, don't go away from it. Even though it's very uncomfortable, you want to hang in there with it. But hang in there with the discomfort and then breathe through it like the breath is a massage. Like the breath is like an anchor that allows you to kind of move through it without being caught by it. And just breathe with it and breathe with it and breathe with it. And that's one of the ways in which we can learn not to identify so strongly with what's happening within us, is breathing through it or with it or whatever. Riding the breath instead of being sucked back into this body sensations that might be there or reacting to them. So breathing with the fear, breathing into the fear, breathing around the fear, holding the fear in the breath within the body is very helpful. It's also helpful to just kind of be very, forget about the breath sometimes, and just be very exact and particular. Where exactly in the body is the fear that you're having? Fear, if it's strong enough, will always have a location in the body. And if you can really anchor your attention in the bodily place, the strongest place in the body where the fear is, one of the things you do is you're disengaging yourself from the ideas of what you're afraid about. And since 95% of the time or more, the ideas are completely irrelevant to what's happening in the present moment, it's a fine thing to do. It's very helpful to do that, to just forget about the ideas and just go and, you know, focus very carefully on the sensations. And by focusing on the sensations, a marvelous thing will sometimes happen. Maybe focusing is the wrong word, because focusing has the implication of kind of narrowing of attention. But if you can hold the sensation in your body, kind of hold the sensations in your awareness, awareness makes room for things. When we're worried and uptight and constricted around something, there's no room for things to move. It's like if you have, you know, if you want to give a big yawn or stretch, and you're in a crowded elevator, you know, there's no room to do that, and you feel kind of like, you know, frustrated and inhibited or whatever. But if no one's in the elevator with you, and it's a big elevator, then, you know, no problem to be a big stretch and a yawn or whatever. And you can kind of unwind. The inner life is that way also. If it's constricted by a very crowded mind, crowded emotions and feelings and reactions and preoccupation in what's going on, there's no room for things to move, which is kind of a paradox because often we want things to move and to go away, but we almost get in our own way by being so caught up by it. But if we can just hold something in awareness very gently, very lovingly, friendly, not trying to force it away, not being aggressive or aversive to it, just holding it in a gentle, full way in awareness, it's like the awareness itself begins to make room for that experience. And as it has room, the body sensations can begin to do what they need to do. And tightening will begin to unwind, will begin to loosen up. And a lot of body sensations that involve some kind of tension or tightening or constriction will begin to unravel if we can very gently and lovingly just hold them, lovingly hold them in awareness. So the first thing is just to breathe with them. The second one is to focus on them or hold them in awareness very consciously and fully. The other thing that can be done is to look at the beliefs around our fears and our worries. You might recognize what you worry about. You might worry about what people are going to think about you. Or you might worry about what you're going to say, or worry about becoming late. Or you might have something that you chronically worry about. But you've never really studied why you believe you need to worry about this. Why do you believe it matters that people think about you in any particular way? Why does it matter when you go into a situation where no one, you know, you never met these people before in your life, and you never meet them again? Why should you be concerned about what they think about you? When I was young, in my teenage years, and maybe early 20s, I used to be extremely worried about what anybody would think about me, whether I knew I was going to see them ever again or not. I'd be worried about, I'd go into, you know, go into some grocery store I'd never been to before, never go into again. I'd be traveling abroad, some country I'd never go back to again. And I'd be worried about something as silly as what they thought about the product I was buying. You know, I can't buy this because the cashier is going to see. It's kind of like, you know, you're going condoms, right? And you go, you know, sometimes that's, you know, worries some people. You know, they go to the cashier and they're flipping it. You know, you don't usually throw your condoms up in the air and say, you know, you know, how much are these? You know, how much are the condoms? Actually, it happened when I was, you know, allow a discretion. Or, no, discretion, that's maybe the wrong phrase. What's the word I want is not discretion. Digression. When I was 17, I was living for a while in Italy and didn't speak, I spoke Italian pretty well, but my vocabulary wasn't complete. So I went with a friend of mine into the pharmacy to try to buy some condoms. But we didn't know the word in Italian for condoms. So we were trying to explain, you know, what a condom is in Italian, you know, using our best Italian to try to explain. And the pharmacist must have, you know, understood, but I guess he was probably just thought it was so funny, and he just, you know, led us on, and we tried harder and harder. And, and finally, someone from across the pharmacy yelled out, "Oh, I know what they want! They want condoms!" So the kind of feeling you might have if you go and buy condoms, you know, Safeway, and you're, you know, I felt about everything I bought. I bought bread or cereal or milk or whatever, you know, it's kind of, it's absolutely absurd, you know. Why does it matter why someone cares what I think about, what they think about me? To look at that question very seriously and very honestly, and begin to massage that question and think about it. Just that very act of questioning the belief that's behind that can begin to take some of its power away from us and make it easier, a little bit easier, slowly, bit by bit. I think there's no magic formula, or very seldom a magic formula, magic insight that's going to solve a lot of things quickly. A lot of wisdom and freedom comes, unfortunately, from familiarity, and just these small steps that we take and learning how it's going on. But being familiar with the beliefs, asking yourselves, what do I believe when I worry about this? What's the fundamental belief that I'm operating on? A lot of people don't question that. And that's one way, a very useful thing to do around fear. And then related to that is just the thoughts. I mean, it's more, you know, many people worry without even knowing what they worry about. So I can say a lot more. Fear is wonderful. A topic. So now it's your turn. I've talked for a long time. And do you have any questions or your comments or your testimonials around fear? Your yes?
When I was in a situation where I might get criticized, and I don't react to criticism well, so I worry about that. And you told me I need to investigate where my fear was around this. And I did that, and one of the things that led to was saying, sort of, a commitment to trying to just be myself. Just be present. And it led to some really good things. Well, all of these things were good. Like some interviews that I had for a job that where I was very relaxed and it actually worked. But sort of the most interesting one was where in a personal situation I had been trying to please somebody and I had been worrying and strategizing on how to make that work. When they would criticize me, I would react the way they would want me to. And I changed that behavior. And, I mean, I was right that about what the person liked. And it's, we've sort of moved apart. But sort of the end of the story is that it's a good thing because being myself is better for me, you know, and it will lead to me to be around people who enjoy that person. I guess the other thing that occurred to me is, so I have this hang-up about wanting to please everybody. If you make this commitment to being yourself and it doesn't work, it is actually likely you'll lose that person because that's yourself. You can't change very easily who yourself is. If you have this other vision of I'm going to strategize and try something. Well, if it doesn't work, you can just come back next time and be another, you know, imaginary person and another one. And so as long as you're hooked to, the goal is to keep everybody pleased by you, it's really enticing, but in the end it doesn't make me any happier.
And what's interesting is that the people who do that, who are constantly adjusting themselves to please other people and other people really don't know who they are. They're also getting just a facade, the game. But what I find interesting is that those people also tend to then lose touch with themselves. And it becomes a very lonely life. And the relationships tend to be kind of shallow then often fragile. Thank you. Yes, please.
Tender feeling of, you know, heartache, that you afraid of the certainty of impermanence.
Uh-huh.
And do you meditate? I mean, like a parent, you always be frightful of what happened to the kid.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that kind of fear?
I'll say something. I don't feel like I understand I understand your question. I don't know if I understand the answer. But since you, especially since you brought up the issue of parental feelings, since I'm a relatively new parent myself, but what I've come to understand or believe or guess or assume or suppose or imagine is that certain kinds of fear seems to be kind of biological, hardwired into us. And the fear of or the concern that a parent has about a child, I think I take it to be kind of a very natural thing, kind of part of just being a parent. I mean, I can overdo it with my child, with my son. I can have neurotic concerns and worries about it, and you know, oh my God, he's never going to get into Harvard, you know. And I haven't had that thought before, but you know, I mean, I can imagine, you know, worry about, you know, such silly things as that. But I think that I suspect that part of, you know, evolution, genetic kind of makeup is for parents is to be tuned in to take care of their kids and keep the kids out of danger. And so there's a kind of I feel in myself now that I have the son, a certain kind of tautness or vulnerability or tenderness in kind of around my solar plexus area in relationship to him that I never had before in my life. And I just take it to be an appropriate, normal thing. I don't have to think of it as a problem. It's just not exactly comfortable. But who said that life's supposed to be comfortable all the time? It just, that's, you know, it seems like it's normal. And, you know, I don't think I have a problem. I don't think I'm neurotic around it. If I was thinking about Harvard all the time, I would think I was neurotic. But I had the first inkling of this when he was just beginning to walk, and how it might be just a natural thing of it being a parent. When I was walking with him in downtown Palo Alto, and I ran into some people I know, and we were talking, and I had my back to the street, and suddenly I became aware that he wasn't next to me, and without, there was no thought at all involved, as far as I could tell, at all. I just I knew where the street was, and so I just pivoted around, you know, and, you know, as quickly as I possibly could to make sure that he was not in the street, and because that's where the danger lied. And somehow, you know, in the gut, I kind of, you know, I was tuned into him in that level of taking care of him. So I think parents have to put up with a certain level of discomfort. How strong that discomfort is, how strong the fear is, probably has a lot to do with other factors besides the gut biological instinct. And I think that if my theory is accurate, that there is this kind of gut kind of biological instinct for parents, then I think that, and since it is uncomfortable, it's a magnet for all kinds of other attitudes and assumptions and beliefs we have about discomfort and fear. So if we're afraid of fear, or we think that's a proof that we're not, you know, that something's fundamentally flawed about us if we have it, or proof that we're neurotic, or if we're really from California and knew how to breathe deeply and knew how to be relaxed, then, you know, we would just let it all hang out and we would never have any uncomfortable feelings at all. Whatever, you know. So it's all these assumptions and beliefs and reactions to that. And one of the functions of mindfulness is to clarify all the extra reactive ways in which we respond to what's going on. So if there's any extra attitudes that are not needed in relationship to this vulnerability that the parent might feel, the function of mindfulness is to clarify that and make that vulnerability simpler and less complicated. That was a very long answer to a simple question. Is that well enough to answer well enough? Please.
I don't exactly know what I'm going to say, but I want to talk about something for a second that's beyond fear, and that's terror. And I think when we are sort of programmed to live a life a certain way, and then we're faced with abruptly turning away from that, that the terror of that degree of change can be immobilizing. And so it's hard for me to imagine in that kind of terror how we breathe and how we observe and how we get quiet when we're completely overwhelmed.
Great question. It's very helpful if a person builds a foundation of a regular meditation practice, regular mindfulness practice, in normal times, so that a certain inner strength is developed, so that in times of crisis, we can call upon that inner strength. So that's, you know, so sometimes people don't have that opportunity, but if you have moments of where you're not terrorized, build your credit during that time, and then bring it with you into the terror. The other thing is to look for help, and not to feel like you have to do it alone. And help can be create a safe environment where it's safe to go into that terror, to make that kind of change. It can be having a therapist or a friend or whatever who you know, hold your hand, perhaps even that dramatically, or you talk to regularly, is available by phone or something, so you know you have a net that can catch you if it gets too much. Retreats for some people are very good places, very safe places, because you're on 10-day retreat, nothing's going to happen to you on the 10-day retreat. It's one of the safest places in the world. Occasionally something happens, but it's one of the safest places in the world, and it's a safe place to let all our normal conventional ways of living in the world fall away, because if you become a completely unconventional person, no one's going to notice on the retreat. And even if they noticed, you know, everyone else is becoming unconventional also. You know, it's okay. You get a lot of support for that exploration. And occasionally, with great terror, it's helpful to actually go through it. Through it here means let it take you over. Occasionally, that's the right call. And retreats are a good place to let something like terror really kind of take over, really see it through. See what happens if you just give yourself over to it. Just abandon yourself to it, you know, and see what happens, and go to the other side. There's many reasons for terror, like you're talking about, when some kind of radical change comes on. But at getting support from others and knowing other people have gone through it, you know, there to provide community for you is helpful. The other thing is it's a little bit of reflection, perhaps, on the fact that we have many different kinds of self, in a sense. And one of the kinds of selves we have is the relational self. It's a self that we form in relationship to other people. And this is really common. Most people's idea of their self is the relational self. How other people see me, and how other people react to me, and how other people, you know, how I speak to them, and the response I get, and kind of we build a repertoire of feedback from our family and society and friends through a lifetime that help create an image of who we are. The world helps us with that image making. And so it's a relational self. It's defined in relationship to people. There's another kind of self, and that's a self which is completely independent of any relationship to any other human being on the planet, or any other to any being outside of ourselves. And it's possible to be completely at peace, filled with peace and joy, without any reference to the relational self. To what some people might call the essential self, or the non-self self, or and it's terrifying for some people to let go of the relational self. Absolutely terrifying. And anybody who's going to do a meditation practice in a deep way, sooner or later, to some degree, whether it's terror or just you know, mild apprehension, will probably go through an experience like this, because we have to. One of the important movements in Buddhist spirituality is to learn to shift our primary identity away from the relational self to a more kind of existential self. And then you're no longer, how you're defining yourself, no longer dependent on the world around you, you're going to be a lot happier. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Can I just second that? That's exactly what you said there. I got this friend that's got this land, and I go camping, and it's 5 hours from here and another hour of dirt road, and it's way back in there. I go every year. And some years I stayed alone. They all left and I had another day off, but sun's getting low and I started to have all these fears. And we know there's a bear up there. Saw it once, it ran away. And there's paramilitary guys with guns somewhere back there. And you know, started getting late, and I just decided to just pack up and leave and stay in some flea bag motel with people playing TVs when I could have stayed in the woods. And this happened a couple of times. That was before I was meditating, and now after nearly 2 years of meditation, I've been back up there and stayed alone twice. In fact, stayed alone for several nights and all day long. So, well, this is my retreat. I'll just spend all day observing my thoughts, and did some exercises like that. And I realized that those times I left, I wasn't afraid of the bears or anything. I was just afraid of being alone. Because I didn't know what to do. I thought, should I be here? Should I maybe be home doing something? I think really I was alone. And I was freaked out about it. And now I'm able to go there and just observe the feelings. And it was really, really nice. And I absolutely attribute it to the meditation of being able to stand back from the fear a little bit and say, oh, I'll see people in a couple days. They'll be there, you know. And so it was just a great, great experience to really watch it after the previous times when I couldn't do it, you know.
Beautiful.
We also found out that the noises in the night, like worrying about the bear with toads.
Yeah. Thank you a lot. So let's just take a couple of minutes to sit quietly before the end.